You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Several times a week, Laura will turn to me after we get into bed and say those six little words I've been waiting to hear all day. Can I read something to you? Once I've said yes, she reaches for an item from her very cluttered nightstand and proceeds to bring that book, blog post, poem, essay, or article to life with her voice. I hope you enjoy listening to her read as much as I do. Here's this week's selection from Laura's Nightstand.
Hi, as Scott said, this is on my nightstand, and I am Laura Cathcart Robbins. Today, I'm reading a piece that was just published in HuffPost Personal by Lisa Cooper Ellison, who is one of the beautiful women that I'm in the memoirists collective with called Moving Forwards. And I had the pleasure of reading this for Lisa. Sometimes as writers, you know, we send each other our work to preview, and was so blown away by it. And then she got it published in HuffPost Personal, which is just phenomenal. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about Lisa. Lisa Cooper Edison is a speaker, writing coach, and editor with an ed.S in clinical mental health counseling and a background in mindfulness. Her life story and essays have appeared on NPR's With Good Reason and in Hippocampus's literary magazine, Kenyon Review Online, and The Guardian, among others. She's currently working on a memoir about how traveling with her husband's heavy metal band into post-Bosnian War Yugoslavia soon after her brother's suicide led to the promise that ultimately saved her. To learn more, you can check out her website, or you can follow her on Twitter at LisaEllisonsPen. The other reason I wanted to read Lisa's piece to you is that this is the last Friday of September, which is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and this piece is about her brother's suicide, and it's just so beautifully done. And it's titled, My 20-Year-Old Brother Died by Suicide. Here's Why I Almost Joined Him. So here we go. A few hours after my brother Joe's funeral, I noticed my father had shrunk. We sat together on my grandparents' couch, him in his special occasion suit and a rumpled tie, me in black pants and a white sweater. As a kid, I'd seen him as the giant who palmed basketballs and touched our ceiling with ease. Now it was as if he'd lopped off a piece of himself and buried it with his son. Later that day, my mother collapsed and cried, "My son, my son." She clawed the air my brother had recently occupied, her fetal ball so tight she looked like a child. My brother's suicide was the lead headline in our hometown newspaper. He died at 20 in the middle of a mental health crisis. Over the past 2 days, we'd screamed, "Why? And how could this happen? And this can't be real." Riddled with shock, we sat in the dark and declined food as if missing meals and ignoring sunsets would bring Joe back to us. Over the next 2 weeks, I searched my parents' eyes for the spark of life they'd once emitted, but they'd permanently dimmed. My mom cried that losing anything else would kill her. Dad told me to remember Joe the way he was. At 22, I nodded and looked away, not yet aware that an equally crushed part of me mourned, not just for my brother, but for a part of my parents I'd also lost. Even if I'd known, that grief would have felt unjustified. I'd been told the death of a child was the worst possible loss. In the sport of grief, it was an automatic Olympic qualifier. My only biological sibling was Joe's twin. Sharing a womb certainly trumped my pain. Then there was my father and stepfather who identified my brother's body, and my stepsister who was too young to understand this heartbreak. I wanted to end their pain, but mine felt so deserved. Sure, at 10, I looked after my brothers during my parents' chaotic and bitter divorce, cooking dinners, rousing them for school, comforting their broken hearts with heavy metal tunes. But I was also the one who moved 600 miles away a few days after my high school graduation, vowing never to return. Every cell in my body knew that I should have been there. I should have recognized the signs. I should have stopped this from happening, but I didn't. And maybe my negligence had killed him. I desperately wanted to fix this situation, which we'd been told could only get worse. A fellow survivor of suicide loss who had attended Joe's funeral said we had an increased risk of dying by suicide. She'd seen it on a pamphlet given out by a local grief support group. It was proof that our family could produce more tragic headlines and statistics. 3 weeks after my brother's death, Mom requested a family meeting. "Promise me you won't take any more risks," she said, her eyes darting between me and my brother. 2 years before Joe's death, I'd started skydiving. At first, I'd hoped to prove I was as cool as my husband's heavy metal bandmates. Soon the sky was my refuge. In the air, peace replaced my painful memories, leaving me feeling completely whole. Fearing I'd kill my mother, I begrudgingly agreed to quit skydiving. At the time, my husband's band was touring Europe. Fearing what might happen if I lost him too, I joined his tour. Every day I tried to live, not because I wanted to, but because our family was gearing up for another loss. 6 months after my brother's death, metastatic colon cancer claimed my grandfather. When I'd visited him during the Thanksgiving before Joe's suicide, it seemed like he might rally. But seeing my brother's casket had taken away his fight. Half orphaned and more broken, my mother seemed smaller still. What if she stopped fighting too? The day we buried my grandfather, I decided I would live not just my life, but also Joe's. Maybe if I was good enough, hardworking enough, and smart enough, people would see us as more than headlines and statistics. Maybe they focus on our healing and not what happened to my brother. Maybe this world would resurrect my parents so they could care for me and not the other way around. 3 weeks before my grandfather's death, I'd registered for 15 credit hours at the university I dropped out of after my freshman year. To fund my education, I maxed my student loans and worked 32 hours per week at a marketing firm during semesters and 50 during breaks. I spent the rest of my time studying. Now that I lived two lives, nothing but 4.0s would do. My skin goose-pimpled when hearing the lilt in my parents' voices any time I said things like, "I'm going back to college for Joe," or "we made the dean's list." In those moments, it was as if for a nanosecond they believed my brother was still with us. By my senior year, I'd been inducted into two honor societies, received two full scholarships, and qualified to graduate at summa cum laude. While the school only allowed me to keep one, the scholarships felt like proof I was really living for us both. The additional funding meant that I could take an easier campus position. Not knowing what to do with my free time, I filled it on behalf of Joe, full course load, computer lab technician, campus newspaper reporter, suicide prevention hotline operator. Life seemed so good, until it wasn't. 2 weeks into my senior year, I started thinking about angles, specifically the angles on the ramp I planned to build so I could drive my car off the university's parking garage. Over the past 2 years, overwork had successfully suppressed my grief. That day, I experienced an odd fatigue as I measured and considered speeds. But I wasn't sad. I didn't feel like a burden or trapped. I had no idea I was planning to die. Besides, why would I want to? My life was supposedly perfect. Perfect school record, perfect number of jobs, a life that was perfectly numb. The day I recognized what was happening, I stood on the top parking deck and thought about all my promises to live. I'd always believed these contracts contained an out clause that I could easily invoke. But now I lived two lives, ending mine with Killjoe a second time. What would that do to my parents? 2 days later, I made an appointment at the university's counseling center. Before crossing the threshold, I said a quick prayer. Please give this person the tools to save me from myself. If she didn't have them, I already knew the outcome. After what felt like hours, a pert blonde with a pixie cut and a flowered jumper called me to her office. She was just a few years older than me. Over the next 30 minutes, she asked a series of questions in her twangy southern drawl. When I told her about my brother in the parking garage, she swallowed hard. Do you have any experience dealing with suicide? I asked. Have you ever been in a place where you felt like you had nothing to lose? My throat clenched around the word lose. She set her file aside, then sat next to me. We sat like that until time was up. She was only supposed to see me for 7 sessions, but she treated me for the next 2 years. In them, I unraveled the stories I'd been telling myself. For years, I'd believed there was a hierarchy of grief. As the daughter who'd left, the sister who'd missed the signs, and the child who couldn't put her parents back together again, I believed my pain belonged on the bottom rung. Eventually, I learned that grief isn't a competition. The only hurt we can really know is our own. It's also the only one we can tend to. As much as I wanted to end my parents' pain, I couldn't. A few weeks before what would have been Joe's 45th birthday, I once again sat next to my father. It was the first time we'd seen each other since the COVID-19 pandemic began, 24 years after Joe's death. I could see how this loss continued to whittle him down. A small part of me still grieves the daddy I lost. Yet, as I held his hand, I reminded myself that I am enough, that we are enough, that our shared grief is what matters. And while we can't walk each other's journeys, we don't have to grieve alone. On My Nightstand is a special segment of the Only One in the Room podcast. Today's episode was produced by Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, and executively produced by Christina Barcy, who we call Barcy. Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible, brand new Only One interview, and every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading from something that I love. If you have an Only One in the Room story or a piece of writing that you'd like to share, please submit it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.